Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. April 15th, which is tomorrow, is usually USA Tax Day, deadline for filing annual income taxes. But this year it is Monday, April 18th, which, being the 110th anniversary of the Great San Francisco Earthquake of 1906, might be aptly called Taxquake Day. The explanation is relatively simple, involving emancipation of slaves and a holiday for government workers. Of course, it has much to do with separate centuries and convoluted calendars. This is not only a leap year, but a leap tax day year. So everybody receives a weekend tax haven before the hammer falls. To add to the confusion, I offer my own rant on Taxquake Day, which I must disclaim as a personal cathartic leap. I call it the tax wars. American history boiled to the bone might be encapsulated as war and money rather than about rights, liberty, and equality. And the reduction might be further compressed if it is argued that the wars have all been fought for money, which would reconfigure the pursuit of wealth as the total fabric of the USA's manifest destiny. This perspective of history is obviously an injustice to those who have struggled and often been jailed, bled, or died for the larger beliefs relevant in the Bill of Rights. Yet the very fact of the intensity of conflict for equity and justice within our own Constitution gives legitimacy to the claim that for the powerful elite, money is the only mainspring of the nation's history. If, indeed, this narrow frame of history has any credence, it must be realized that a select few have from the very beginning profited from the collective effort of the many. In this context, the term freedom is misplaced, both politically and economically. Free enterprise is a misnomer for the fact that throughout the country's 240-year history, from 1776, the wealthiest Americans have primarily accumulated and maintained their wealth at public expense, mostly through subsidies made available by taxation of everyone else, and most recently, gigantic bailouts of the financial sector that has nearly bankrupted the nation, as well as much of the world, which can also be defined as the blood and taxes of the majority who generally make possible but seldom share in the abundance. Newt Gingrich used to say, "The engine that pulls the train must be refueled." By that he meant the Nauvoo Federalists of wealth and business should not share tax obligations with the common folk. Affluent taxpayers must receive breaks because they invest money and create jobs for others, Newt explained disingenuously, as if it hadn't been said before. In reality, those affluent taxpayers and job creators rarely invest in anything except their own portfolios, and they not only do not pay their share of taxes, they gorge on public money which people like Gingrich and former President G.W. Bush call welfare when it is distributed among the less prosperous and investment when extorted by the rich. At the same time, our political lords cut off welfare to single mothers and downsized workers. They initiate special tax breaks to favored corporations that amount to billions of dollars. They cut the taxes of big business, which invests a portion into the welfare of favored politicians, and the rich, who are shareholders in most of these same corporations, and spoil them with billions more subsidies they claim are essential to the free market, which is regarded as a natural force. Public services and poverty programs are gutted to make up the shortfall. The rich get richer, and everybody else gets poorer because they subsidize the rich. That is national tax policy. Corporations are, after all, inherently socialist rather than capitalist. Big business does not compete for sheer love of competition in an unfettered emporium of commerce, which is the myth of capitalism. The almighty free market is, in truth, a savage battleground to dominate the American economy in a bitter, ruthless goal of winner take all. The neo-Tories quote Thomas Jefferson, twist him into a laissez-faire philosopher, Gingrich again. When Jefferson said, every generation needs a revolution, he wasn't making an argument for chaos. He was making an argument for creative replacement of the old order with a new order, quote unquote. And that was Gingrich. But old Tom's intent was to replace a repressive and corrupt colonial government with a truly revolutionary guarantee of power to the people. The new Tories' purpose is to return the USA to the vertically organized and patronage-dominated 18th century that the American and French revolutions blew asunder, attempting to reestablish an old order of privilege and power based on wealth and property in this new millennium, runs counter to Thomas Paine's common sense vision of a decent and prosperous life for ordinary Americans who are assumed to be rulers rather than ruled. The plutocrats who control the major corporations claim the economy defines the nation more than its principles. Money, they say, is the nation's ideology. What they mean by their strict definition of the economy is their own personal domination of the national wealth. In theory, everybody has an equal chance to make a buck and live the American dream. But in reality, a very few are far more equal than the rest. The only real distinction of this country is not wealth or power, but the fact the great majority of ordinary people who do not have much wealth are constitutionally the fundamental sources of government power. Yet the wealthy minority dangerously fool themselves that their money entitles them to authoritarian control as a corollary to wealth. The democratic system is rapidly retrogressing to an aristoplutocracy of gigabuck family dynasties and immense multinational corporations. Monetary policies that singularly benefit the upper layers of society draw money from less well-off levels, which keeps them less well-off and always under pressure to pay what is demanded. Releasing public money, most of it pried from middle class and blue-collar labor, to business and wealthy elites is considered sound investment and essential to the economy. Providing public funds to the public is regarded as uneconomical and a severe drain on the national treasury. Corporations receive rebates on taxes they never paid and resent government intrusion, and that's a quote, into their affairs, criticizing regulations regarding their methods of business. However, corporate capitalists do not think government tax breaks or subsidies for big banks and business should be curtailed, and certainly not huge bailouts of tax money when their risky financial policies drive them and most of the rest of the country into insolvency. The rupture between corporate profit and national economic stability is a derivative of the dependence of the private sector's profits on its sanctioned pillaging of the public treasury. Billions of dollars are appropriated from such important areas as healthcare and housing. The private plunder of the public domain extends to natural resources that are despoiled with scant regard for either long or short-term consequences. Shipping jobs offshore, NAFTA et al., lays off millions of workers, which cuts tax revenues and necessitates huge welfare costs the corporate capitalists who eliminate the jobs are not paying and pressure to abolish, leaving already burdened middle and working class taxpayers to cope with the deficit. The domestic decline of the United States is also the fault of the so-called military-industrial complex. Mention of Congress as its third leg is left out. This giant interlocking mafia of corporations, politicians, and military appropriations wastes hundreds of billions of public money at the expense of internal civic disintegration in the holy names of defense, national security, and the war on terrorism, which, like privatized prison sentences, appears to be perpetual. Even if we eventually surface from the economic disaster brought on by Wall Street and its satellite casino banks, the Pentagon's bloated budget has soared into a huge black hole into which everything is eventually drawn and disappears, in particular the nation's wealth and resources. The upward flow of the nation's wealth has to be reversed and the arid trickle-down become a flood if the national economy is to be overhauled. The cancerous disparities in wealth and living standards, major causes of the homeless epidemic, undermine our society and threaten civil disorder on a scale that presupposes a grim specter of the future worse than terrorism. Remedies for repairing our ravaged economy and reversing the intolerable social catastrophe it has precipitated are many, varied, and complex, and depend on reapplying the nation's fundamental principles with fresh interpretations, especially social, political, and legal equality of gender and race. The reestablishment of a union culture plus radical reform of labor laws and practices should be primary goals for the good reasons that labor and production are at the heart of political and economic recovery. Across the board, tax reform that drastically reduces the military budget and eliminates the two-tiered tax system in which the privileged get most of the breaks, which includes legal and illegal tax shelters and shell companies, and the majority of the citizenry pay the bulk of taxes, should be a priority consideration for returning power to the people. The tax system must be mandated in favor of taxpayers, guaranteeing each one a factual accounting of tax money used by every level of government, and that basic returns for that money be automatic priorities such as food, shelter, and health and medical care. After that, the basic infrastructures of a society that are the basis for taxation should be maintained, such as transportation and energy provisions that must obviously be environmentally friendly and global warming conscious, as well as public health and safety, emergency relief, and general livability for average citizens. The present system of required payment of taxes without any accountability for their use must be inverted, which is possible with computerization of all public agencies. It will eventually be feasible in such a system that taxpayers have the legal power to determine how and where their tax monies are spent. An immediate essential of tax reform would be to charge the national debt to corporations that not only owe hundreds of billions of dollars in back taxes, from fraudulent accounting generally, but have received huge refunds of public money for taxes they never paid. The liability has been on the average taxpayer who receives only the bill, but not the benefits of government borrowing. Tax reform would necessitate elimination of corporate and individual tax havens, which recent disclosure of the Panama Papers has starkly illuminated. A simultaneous action would be to prohibit corporate inversion therapies, which are mergers with foreign companies that pay lower taxes. Tax reformers usually attempt to allocate more tax monies to environmental and poverty programs and support many creative ideas such as energy and environmental taxes, as well as usage and consumption taxes. Progressive taxation is the fairest redistribution from the wealthy to those most in need, but ultimately, only a strong and determined tax revolt by a large number of ordinary citizens will bring about adequate and necessary tax reform. The debate over income taxes is long-standing and bitter. Groups both politically right and left wish to abolish the current tax system, which they claim is unconstitutional, despite the superseding of original intent by the 16th Amendment. With the exception of the Civil War, Americans did not pay income taxes until 1913, and withholding taxes deducted from wages was a World War II innovation, which has precipitated enormous furor ever since. It is quite probable the government would consider massive rebellion by taxpayers the worst conceivable form of terrorism, and savagely respond with a campaign of extra-legal police state-style counter-terror, which is why any such revolt would have to occur in stages and obviously involve the courts, as well as simply refusing to file tax forms, and must appeal to the most fundamental doctrines of the nation. Paradoxically, the theory of progressive taxation might as well be Marxist. Each pays according to his or her ability, according to their needs and obligations. The theory is that what is taken out of society should also be proportionately put back. The more you get, the more you are obliged to return. The reality is that those who reap the most give back the least, if they give back at all, and that which they keep is unproportionately made up by taxing those who reap the least. The greatest tax upon the society is the enormous cash flow of public money that disappears into the private fortunes of those who arrogantly loot the national treasury in full knowledge their larceny is sanctioned with nary a question asked. Perhaps as good an example of the inequity of the current tax system is that public money has been apportioned without public consent to bail out financial firms whose criminal avarice created the economic collapse that has doomed millions of ordinary Americans to job losses and home foreclosures. Instead of being tried as criminals, these wealthy elites purchase not only the corrupt minds and shriveled souls of elected lawmakers, but also the law itself. The dismal hypocrisy is that the public treasury is being exhausted to maintain not only the vast wealth of those who have shattered the family finances of a majority of Americans, but also to subsidize further criminal financial behavior that will lead to more economic disaster. The people who could really use their own money for basics such as food, housing, and health care, especially the millions rendered destitute from job loss and home foreclosures caused by the recession depression, are instead caught in a circular process of propping up mega wealthy banks, corporations, and individuals who seem to think they can plunder the public purse forever. One might regard the involuntary and undemocratic bailout by American taxpayers as a contemptible theft of a public trust. In truth, we the people seem to be little more than cash conduits for banks too politically connected to fail, whose financial policies paradoxically decimate prospects of even a decent living for the average citizens whose taxes bail them out. An accelerating disparity between the wealthy and everybody else, and the use of law and politics to oppress the deprived, endangers the remaining democracy and equity in this country. Economic inequality is not a natural phenomenon, but is premeditated policy, such as is first-degree murder. Theodore Roosevelt had it right when he said, "The real enemy of anarchist capitalists are socialist working people." And that was something I wrote, The Tax Wars. And I'd like to remind everybody that Sunday, April 17th, is KMUN's 33rd birthday. I made my debut on KMUN almost 2 years later as a radio reporter on February 20th, 1985, after reading parts in a couple of radio plays the previous year. Perhaps it was aptly pertinent that my first report for KMUN's 15-minute weekly news program at the time was a story about garbage. The following is that story, which was recorded over a telephone, exactly what I'm doing with it again 31 years later. The disposal of garbage, and this is my story, like that of nuclear waste, is a problem that has the sympathy of everyone as long as the solutions are not in their neighborhoods. Astoria has been wrestling with the problem for quite a while and thought that finally it was resolved with acceptance of a transfer site on the riverfront, which would compact the garbage and send it up to Washington landfills and incineration after ideas that were rejected as too expensive or were met with too much hostility from residents of areas under consideration. The company that picks up the city's garbage convinced officials that it could transfer the stuff up to Washington from property it owned on the waterfront with less expense and greater aesthetics. However, a local bottling plant objected. Its operation was right next to the place where the garbage was to be dumped and compacted. There would be terrible sanitation problems, the bottling company said. Not only the smell, but the old horror of rats in cola bottles was envisioned from the swarms that might be attracted to the garbage next door. The garbage company deferred and withdrew its application, which puts the city back at the beginning. Once again, areas that thought themselves safe will be looked at seriously. Perhaps in retrospect, Hanford, which is a terrible idea for nuclear waste, might be a reasonable solution to Astoria's garbage. When I telephoned that story into KMUN back in 1985 from an outside phone booth, the streets were virtually empty. The instant Catherine Snow, who was KMUN program director at the time, started the tape recorder at the station, a garbage truck probably fittingly, rumbled down the street and turned noisily into a parking lot next to the phone. A car without a muffler roared its engine and honked its horn. Two men shouted at one another, and a gaggle of kindergarten children came into sound range, screaming and laughing. I wrote and recorded my second story on KMUN 2 weeks later on March 5th, 1985. And this is the story. One of the most prevalent images in the nation is that this is a time of increasing prosperity, a time of reasserting the American century. The president, Ronald Reagan, is the salesman of this image, a veritable grandfather Moses in his comfortable paintings of the happy countryside. His brushes are not as quick to paint out entirely more unsettling images, however, such as a national physician's report last week of rising hunger in the country or the growing number of homeless families. The suffering caused by the gutting of social programs to finance military weapons has not been successfully kept out of focus, and the cheerful statistics about increasing employment have not obscured the long, patient lines of out-of-work men and women who wait for a job of any sort. The specter visited Astoria this week when almost 200 waited to fill out applications for perhaps a dozen jobs. Most of them had been laid off. They were loggers, woodworkers, construction workers, fisher people, waitresses, housekeepers, truck drivers, a couple who had been laid off from a mink farm, and they were from as far away as Scappoose and the peninsula. Most of them spent Sunday night on the sidewalk in a cold rain, wrapped in sleeping bags, strips of plastic, or in nothing more than pants and a jacket, waiting for the state employment office to open Monday morning. 100 applications for work at the Crown Zellerbach paper mill in Wana were handed out for such jobs as folding napkins and packaging toilet paper. At least half of those who waited were turned away without an application. Carol Eckert, communications manager for Crown Z in Portland, said few of those who even made an application will actually end up with a job. And then a taped interview with Carol Eckert ended my story. After she was finished, I signed off with my name and station identification, which I think finished my short career as a KMUN radio reporter. A couple of years later, I got stuck in this program in 1987. So happy birthday, number 33, to KMUN. And in the program, I'd like to mention something which saddens me very much. Rick Bartow died on Sunday, April 2nd. He was a fervent poet, artist, and sculptor, and a damned fine musician. He was a Native American activist, born a Mad River Wyot and accepted as a Silas, which reflected his art, and a Vietnam veteran against the war, which affected his poetry. John Harrington of Newport, where Rick lived all his life, wrote a tribute which appeared in the Newport News Times. Rick Bartow died last Saturday. I knew him, but he didn't know me. I saw his art in Cafe Mundo, recognized his sculptor in downtown Portland, and heard him sing and play with the backseat drivers many times. I was the tall bearded guy in the back. I don't know exactly why I'm writing this, except that I feel bad for him, his loved ones, and everyone he touched, including me, whom he never met. And that was John Harrington. Rick was an old friend from the Vietnam War protest years, and afterward he helped my poverty press newspaper, the North Coast Times-Eagle, stay alive with his music, poetry, and his spirited savoir. I'd like to read two of Rick's poems that appeared in the Times-Eagle. Ambushed Forever. The father gently passed the teeth, a phallic offering for peace and silence, to a man whose last will was completely surrendered to the first finger of his right hand. The son, the father's only son. No immaculate conception this, only common dirt hard work, now older than his old man, a walking recruit poster, a grunt, a ground pounder, a leatherneck. He's crazy off the street and he knows it. He gets drunk, tired, and he feels it going. Black boots running through the fire, a streetlight in early morning drizzle, finds him yelling, "Why does a vet take it so personally? Last night I blew it again, caught forever in a black and white film, forever mid-frame, trapped in an ambush position until the frame burns." The lover, "I had a little girl out there, out here, but I saw her last night in the dark out here, just where that street dead ends. His hands, like leather gloves, reveal, as do his red-rimmed eyes, a landscape that his little girl couldn't long tolerate. The tavern. And your eyes don't, if your eyes don't close, where will you sleep? No rest in this movie. Let's have another drink. The baby Jesus marches with me and keeps me strong, he says suddenly. Then yelling a military cadence, his core's eyes begin to wander the zone, and he lunges into the night with a pool cue bayonet to seek and destroy. In the street, the film continued. He becomes the star just as the frame begins to melt, distorted in the heat. His hands revert from handworking tools to menacing extensions. There will be no reinforcements this time. There will be no support. Yet the raid will go on and on. Truly one of the few good men forever. And that was in the Times Eagle, June 29, 1984. And farewell, Asia, soldier and the Australian whore. Can it be that we are dreams created by one for the other to shape life anew from a sleep troubled by loneliness and fear? Forms bound by purpose begin in dream lines we create ourselves, a song that the tongue refuses the lips. The words are lost on ears deafened by a sleep that the eye refuses. The departure, preordained by necessity, sees the voyage of hands over skin as the night blind seek reverence of a way home again and again, across rutted streets, away from dark indifference. And that was from October 2003, Times Eagle. And that was two poems by Rick Bartel. A public memorial service for Rick will be held on April 30th at the Newport Performing Arts Center. And I sign off today, just as I did in 1985. This is Michael McCusker for KMUN.